Today's Teisho will be on case 24 in the Heikigan Roku, the PNU, the Blue Rock Collection. Case 24 is entitled Ryutetsuma, the Old Female Buffalo. Engo's introduction. Standing on the highest mountaintop, no devil or heretic can approach him. Descending to the farthest depths of the sea, he is not to be seen even by the Buddha's eyes. Even if your eye is like a shooting star, your spirit like lightning, you are still like the turtle, which cannot avoid dragging its tail. At such a juncture, what do you do? See the following. Main subject. Ryutetsuma said to Isan, Ryutetsuma came to Isan. Isan said, old female buffalo, so you have come. Tetsuma said, tomorrow there is a great festival at Taishan. Will you be going? Isan lay down and stretched himself out. Tetsuma went away. Secho's verse. Riding an iron horse, the general entered the double-walled fortress. The imperial proclamation. The six kingdoms are at peace. Still gripping the golden whip, he urges the returning troops. In the quiet depths of the night, no one goes with him through the king's streets. I want to thank everybody for coming here this morning. It's wonderful to see every one of you. I'm very glad you can be here. I know a number of people have very busy schedules, and it's just really wonderful to see each and every one of you. Just now we did our kinhin. So we started at 7. This morning, and we recited sutras, and then we had a little tea and a bathroom break, and then we sat down and got to work, and we did three sits without a break, and then there was a bathroom break, and then two more sits without a break, and then we got up and did our kinhin. I have taught in this building a number of times, and I have come into this area here and gotten the mail or talked to Emma, the secretary, and then raced out and run down those that hallway and gone into teacher class. Or I've come in through the side door, maybe with only a minute to spare before class starts, and raced into one of the rooms. And, you know, people are coming and going, and doors are slamming, and so on. I get in the classroom and take the attendance and start the lesson. But this morning it was so different, you know. I've raced down that hallway many times, thinking about my lessons, thinking about other issues, you know. But today, you know, we lined up and we walked out into the hallway, and it's such a different experience. If you are moving slowly and your mind is freer from thoughts and emotional turmoil, if your mind is somewhat clear, just walking down the hall can be quite an amazing experience. Probably it's possible to get from one end of that hall to another in less than a minute if you're really hurrying. But it took us about maybe 7 minutes, maybe 10 minutes to go from one end of the hall to the other. And You know, when the mind has been sitting on, when you've been sitting on the cushion for an hour or 3 hours, your mind is calmer, fewer thoughts, your thoughts are not at the center of your attention, emotional turmoil is has receded, and your mind is calmly, serenely dwelling in the moment. And you take a step, and you can feel the tiles underfoot, surprisingly not cold, right? Sort of warm. You can feel the tiles underfoot. You can feel the weight of your body coming down on your foot. You can feel the muscles in your leg. You can feel the muscles in your spine. You can feel maybe temperature in the room. You might hear the whirring of the engine in the water fountain. As we were walking down the hall, I could hear the whir of the forced air heating system. And in one of the classrooms, the forced air was hitting one of the blinds, so it was making a little clicking sound, And, you know, walking is a whole different kind of experience. It's very, you know, if you just try to pay attention to what's actually happening in the moment as you're walking, you realize that so much is happening. It's an extraordinary amount of information. You're registering the temperature of the room. There's not just a sound, there's many different sounds. You know, I'm quite convinced that the cement of the floor is not always even. Every once in a while, I'll come to a place when we do keening where it feels like the floor is rising up a little bit. And I don't think it's my imagination. I think the cement is not totally even. There's places where it dips just a little bit. Probably your eye can't notice it, or my eye can't. But you can feel it when you're walking. And if you begin to pay attention to your just your body sensations as you walk, you realize that there's quite a bit of information. There's quite a few sensations. If you're paying attention to your hearing, you'll notice there's quite the air is quite filled with different kinds of sounds. You know. And of course, the hallway, you might have noticed, is not all one temperature. You know, at different parts of the hallway, it's warmer or cooler. You know, this is all, you know, information that we normally just ignore. You know, if you're in a hurry, you're not paying attention to your body at all. You're just trying to get from point A to point B. If you have a stone in your shoe, you can't block it out. So you stop and you take off your shoe and you take the pebble out of your shoe. But ordinarily, we're just sort of like suppressing all that information because we have something to do or somewhere to go. And so there's a kind of active suppression, really, of information. And when we can stop and spend a few hours purifying body, mind, and heart, when we can practice shamatha, and the mind becomes still, and the thoughts recede, and you begin to dwell calmly in the moment, with a one-pointed attention. You know, the whole world is quite different in ways that would seem subtle when your mind is crude, but when your mind is more purified, it's quite remarkably profound. So, you know, I was just surprised this morning by how many sensations I experienced just in putting my foot down on the cement. And of course, it's not continuous. You know, you're aware of your foot, you're aware of your knee. I have some arthritis in both of my in my right foot and my left knee, so I can always feel like this little pain there every time I take a step. You know, that's part of it. And then, you know, your attention turns to something else. And when your attention turns to something else, like the sound, your awareness of body disappears. You know? So there's this complex interplay of different kinds of awareness as you're going down the hall. And it's really quite remarkable to have a purified mind and to feel the muscles, you know, moving forward. And it's really quite energizing. And for no particular reason, it's really quite wonderful. And it feels very good. When we do sitting in the evening, we always end with tea and some kind of a sweet. And, you know, if you were to, you know, I myself drink tea all day. I love tea. I love tea. I don't know. There are very few things in life that I love more than tea. I really love it. And I probably drink, I don't know how many cups. I don't even want to think about it. But it's totally healthy, right? So why worry, you know? And I love tea. And I drink it while I'm grading papers. I drink it after my meal. I drink it. But there's something special about the tea after sitting, right? You know, and you just, you could have a gallon of tea, and especially if you're like listening to the radio or you're reading your computer screen and you're drinking tea, you don't even notice it, right? You know, or you notice it very, it's a very faint awareness. Again, you know, we have a date or a cookie. You could be watching TV and you could have a bag of cookies. You could eat the whole bag and they would be gone in a second, and it would be like, did I eat those cookies, you know? But when we practice shamatha, quieting the mind and sweeping away distractions, and the mind becomes calm and dwelling serenely in the moment, you know, and then you drink that tea, it's just so delicious, right? And you have a date or you have a little cookie, and it's just so powerful an experience. Well, just walking can be like that, you know. Some of us have just come back from a sesshin. And as I always say, you know, sesshin is the heart of Zen practice. It's the most wonderful thing in the world. And you know, we meditate, really, if you count all the times we're on the cushion, we meditate about 9 hours, 8 or 9 hours. And if you count, we also have some break periods where people do extra sitting. So at sesshin, it's possible to sit for about 10 hours. You know. And if you do meditation for 8 to 10 hours for just a couple days, you know, and you hear the sound of the wind, or the sound of a bird, it's just so remarkably beautiful. And you know, you might feel it make your whole body vibrate. And it's quite remarkable, you know. The world is really a beautiful place to be. You know, part of the reason we don't experience it in this way is, of course, our mental habits. You know, we have this capacity to suppress, you know, what's around us, and sometimes it's necessary. So, you know, you can't think of everything at once. If you have to get to your class you know, I this semester I'm teaching up in the river dorms, and my office is in Murray Hall, So, you know, I really don't have time to spend an hour walking slowly and mindfully to my office, I mean to my class. You know, I just have to, generally I leave myself 10 minutes. So I have some tea, I slosh down some tea, and I race out the door of my office, and I go down the stairs, and I walk up George Street. And if I don't have the right shoes on, my arthritis, it's like, ouch, 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 ouch. And I get into the building, and then I, you know, have to take off my coat, and it's a, so it's not necessarily, I'm thinking about the lesson, you know, we have to do that sometime, but we develop a kind of habit of like suppressing, you know, what's around us. And sometimes we do this, we develop this habit because it's just impossible to be aware of everything, you know. One of our members lost his wallet the other day and was feeling very incompetent because he lost his wallet. And then two other people that he talked to said, oh yes, well I recently lost my wallet. And, you know, losing your wallet is okay. It's not a criminal offense. It's not true that if you practice Zen long enough, you won't lose your wallet. You know? That's just not true. The great Zen master Hakuin was walking down the street, actually a country road in Japan, and he was focusing so much on his meditation practice as he walked that he wasn't looking wasn't looking forward. He was looking down. And he walked right into a big buffalo coming the other way. Farmer was bringing his buffalo, and it knocked him right on his ass. You know. So it's okay if you're caught up in the majesty of the moment. You know, you might lose your wallet. That happens. You know, or if you're caught up in the sweep of the moment. But it's hard to manage all of this, right? And so we cultivate a sort of like art of suppression, screening out. And we make a habit out of this. And I think we pay a high price for that, you know? And also sometimes we learn how to screen out because we have unpleasant experiences. You know, there's a kind of dissociation that people learn to do when they're frightened or injured, you know. This is quite common. I mean, when I was a little kid, I was a very shy person. And when I was in school, like in the first grade and so on, I was very sensitive about, you know, I just felt like I was not appropriate. I don't know where I got that from, but I was very shy and I was afraid of people laughing at me, you know. It was a big fear of mine. And I remember once that my mother had bought me, I think it was like a Superman lunchbox. In those days, the kids used to take their lunch to school all the time. I think every kid in our class used to just bring lunch in a metal lunchbox. And every lunchbox had a thermos for milk, and your mother would make you a sandwich, and we would have a little meal time, and we'd all get our lunchboxes from the coat room and put them on the table. And my mother had bought me this lunchbox. I think it was a Superman lunchbox, but it might have been some other, like Roy Rogers, cowboy lunchbox. And anyway, I had gone to school very proud of my new lunchbox, but then as I was taking it out of the coat room, I was probably thinking, oh, look at my new lunchbox, you know. And then I was walking over to the desk and everybody started laughing at me. And I was so shy that this was like mortifying for me. I looked around and everybody's laughing at me, you know. And I just felt terrible. And I looked behind me and my lunchbox was leaking milk, right? And And there was a trail of milk all the way from the coat room to where I was standing. Now, if I had been a little bit more mature, I would have been able to see that this was like a very funny and absurd situation, but I was unable to enjoy the moment, you know. And I remember just sinking out of the, sinking away. It was just like I just disappeared. And that I can remember doing that many times as a little kid, where I would just sort of like, my face would just turn beet red when I was embarrassed, and I would just sort of like, it would be like everything suddenly became very distant. I don't know if that ever happened to you when you were a little kid, but it's like you're so, you're suddenly embarrassed, or you're suddenly ashamed, or you wish you were somewhere else, and you just, everything just becomes very remote. It's like a haze or a film goes over everything around you, and you're suddenly sort of like alone, you know. Since then I've read about dissociative experiences, you know. And in one of the in the book The Freshman Reader we use, there's an article by a woman whose name is Stout, Martha Stout. And she is a psychoanalyst who works with people who suffer from various kinds of dissociative disorders. And one of her clients was a woman named Julia, who was, I believe she was a big person in publishing. She was like a bigwig in the world of publishing, a very senior editor and very accomplished and brilliant woman. And she was really like the head of some publishing division. And she came to the psychiatrist, to the psychoanalyst, because of a problem she had detected, where she had, I think it was basically, she had come to work on a Monday, or she had left work on a Friday, that was it. And she knew she had an appointment on like Wednesday. So she left on Friday and she knew she had a big meeting on Wednesday. And so she got to work on Monday, and her secretary said, "Are you ready for the big meeting?" And this woman, the editor, said, "Well, wait, the big meeting is not until Wednesday." And the secretary said, "It is Wednesday." See? And she had no memory of any events since she left her office on Friday night, like zero. And of course, she knew that she could, you know, quote unquote, space out. But as it turns out, when she began to talk to the psychoanalyst, she realized that there were huge stretches of time in her life that she couldn't recall. So the psychoanalyst said, "Well, tell me about where you lived when you were a child." And the woman, whose name was Julia, the editor, Julia said, "I can't remember where I used to live. I mean, tell me about your house. I can't remember my house." And huge stretches of her childhood were gone. So it was a rather tragic story, because it turns out that she had suffered abuse as a child and had learned to dissociate, you know. In other words, just disappear. And it, completely and totally, the world was gone, time was gone. I've actually met people who have this capacity, you know. One of the reasons we don't use a keisaku, the teaching stick, in our practice is an experience I had many years ago when I was sort of like head of, I was the Zendo head, the head of the Zendo, in charge of the Zendo at the Seattle Zen Center. The person who has that job is called in Japanese a jiki jitsu. It's really like the timekeeper. And the jikijitsu's job is to monitor the sits, so you control the clock. And also, we don't do this here, but in our Zen group in Seattle, we had a more traditional format. And The Jikijutsu would get up at the beginning of each sit and take the stick, the teaching stick, off the altar. And in Chinese, this is called an incense board. But in Japanese, it's called a teaching stick. And they look very similar. They're flat. They look like cricket mallets. Only they're not as hard as a cricket mallet. They're made with a kind of pine wood. And they're flat, and sort of like paddles. And the Jikijutsu's job is to go up and down the rows of sitters and make sure that their posture is correct. And if anybody moves, you get hit with the stick. And there's a ritual for hitting. You get hit with the stick, not anywhere on your body, but in a particular place. There is a meaty part of your back. If you bend over, on each side of your spine, there's a big layer of muscle covering your rib cage. It's under your scapula, under your scapula. And they hit you there, and it's a slap, and it's pretty sharp. And it doesn't leave any bruises, and it doesn't hurt you in any way, but it's painful. It's like it's a really sharp slap. And there's three in the summer and four in the winter. I guess you get more slaps in the winter. But generally, they're given to people who move during the sit, or they're given to people who are asleep. So at our last session, we had somebody day two who we heard going, and we didn't have the teaching stick, however, so he escaped. But my job was to hit people with the stick if they started snoring like that. So anyway, I was patrolling the aisles very diligently, and there was this guy who was lying down. He had fallen over on his cushions, and he was sleeping, and he was going, his name was Mick. So when I saw this, I just went ballistic, right? I thought, this is absolutely unacceptable. You know? So I woke him up and put him back on his cushion, and then I went to patrol the other end of the room, and when I came back, lo and behold, so I put it, I got him into the proper position and smacked him with a mallet, with this, mallet's not the right word, it's like a flat paddle. And I hit him, I hit him, it wasn't like that, it was more like, that's how it sounds. That's one side, you do two sides, right? And then the person's supposed to bow and say thank you for helping me wake up. Anyway, this is a standard feature of Zen practice in most places. But when I hit him with the paddle and went away, I thought, well, that will teach him to go to sleep in my Zendo. But in fact, I came back and he was asleep again. And I woke him up and hit him again with Well, anyway, as I later discovered, he had narcolepsy. So his father had hung him upside down in the closet. He had been taken away from his family because of child abuse, and social services had taken him away. And he had had a long struggle to recover from his incredibly cruel parents, and had put his sanity together again, and so on and so on. And then he had decided to do Zen, and it was my terrible mistake to hit him with this paddle. So after that, I made a vow never to use the keisaku again. But we became good friends, and he didn't hold it against me because he had such a beautiful heart. Somebody who had suffered so extraordinarily. Had this incredibly generous and childlike nature. Really remarkable person. And anyway, he told me, that his father used to physically abuse him and then actually hang him upside down in the dark in a closet. And so he learned to completely, he would say, just go to sleep. So he would just black out, basically, And by the way, a woman came to see me on Friday. in my job as director of the writing program. She was a very intelligent Asian American woman who was an economics major, and she had failed English 101 six times. And she brought me some of the papers, and they're really interesting papers. It had just come to my attention that she had failed this course six times and couldn't graduate. So we got to talking, and she has a kind of a profound stress reaction where she blacks out. She's actually blacked out during tests, you know. So people have this capacity to like black out and make everything disappear. And part of it is like defense mechanism, right? Yeah. And when we become adults, we may not black out like this poor young woman, and we may not fall asleep in the zendo, but we're very good at dissociating from the world. And when we dissociate, often we fill it up with fantasies or thoughts. You know, thoughts are a kind of fantasy, as a matter of fact. And of course, the ability to make the world disappear in this way is not necessarily a curse, right? Because when we do zazen, we also make the world disappear. Yeah. When you're in deep mushin, everything disappears. And indeed, deep mushin is not just just a dissociated state, but a special aspect of reality itself, in my opinion. But when we do Zen practice, generally people watch the breath until they can enter samadhi, until they can enter shamatha, serenely dwelling in the moment. And then we do mu meditation, in which we, when you're in deep mu, everything disappears. So this capacity to dissociate is like either a curse or like the door to enlightenment, depending on how you use it. So one of the interesting things about the ability to dissociate is that you can use it to liberate yourself from your fears and attachments. And it's possible to enter a state in which everything disappears, and when you come out of that state, you experience reality in a very different way. You know, maybe instinctively people go into dissociated states because they're looking for that that transformation. Or that, yeah, maybe transformation is the best word. It's like when we go into a mushin, the deep emptiness, and we come out, you know, everything really can be deeply transformed. It's like that tea, which before would just be something to slosh down, is suddenly like heavenly nectar. And there's a transformation that comes from that, if you want to call it, that dissociated state. Maybe people like Julia and people like Mick, my friend, were looking for that, but they just hadn't found it yet. And when you come out of that state, if you come out of it in the right way, you really do experience the world in a very different fashion. You know, we imagine that. One of the most beautiful things about that state is that you begin to feel other things as part of yourself. Often this happens with sound. So it's quite common for somebody at a sesshin, at a retreat, to be in deep mushin, in which everything disappears, yes? And everything's disappearing, and then suddenly you emerge from that state and you might hear like the sound of the rain. And it's just the like not only the most beautiful sound in the universe, but it's also like it feels like it's somehow your sound, like something you're doing yourself. Genki Roshi used to talk about the fact that his first awakening experience, his first Kensho experience, happened when he was a boy doing a sesshin at Ryutakuji. And he was a little, he was adopted by a great Zen master named Yamamoto Genpo. Genki Roshi was a war orphan, and Yamamoto Genpo was not familiar with how to raise children, and he volunteered to take Genki. But, you know, when Genki was about 12 years old, he was already coming to sesshin, or not voluntarily, he was being made to go to sesshin. And so this poor little kid was doing 10 hours of zazen a day. And he couldn't leave because that was his house, you know. Anyway, Genki Roshi said he would sit there on the cushion, and his legs hurt, every part of his body hurt, and he would just pray for an earthquake to come. You know, in Japan they have a lot of earthquakes. He'd pray for an earthquake to come and just have the roof come down and kill him, so he'd be out of his misery. And then he said he got up from the sit, and they had a bathroom break, and he went into the bathroom, and in the Zen temple next to the toilet, they didn't really have a flush toilet, they have a hole in the ground. Next to that there's an altar. And on the altar there were some flowers, and Genki said he looked at the flowers and he suddenly knew that he was the flowers. Now I don't think this is an illusion at all. I think that Genki experienced a deep connection with the flowers, his oneness with the flowers. Everything is really one life. You know, recently I read this article about a brain scientist whose name was, whose last name is Skarda. I can't remember her first name right now, but she is a Tibetan nun. And she was a brain scientist, and she was studying human intelligence and human awareness. And she couldn't figure out how the brain takes all of these little experiences of sound, of sight, and makes them into a big whole. Makes, you know, the world we experience isn't just isolated incidents, it has a kind of coherence or oneness to it. And she thought, how does the brain do that? But interestingly, you know, the more she studied the matter, the more she realized that the brain experiences things as a whole, and then it cuts them up into little pieces. Well, I think dissociation, fear and injury, teach us how to cut up the world. But I think when we do Zen practice, we begin to return to our natural state of connectedness with things. You know, connectedness. And when you go into deep mushin and you come out, sometimes you just have this extraordinary a feeling of oneness with things. You might not feel oneness, but just you feel alive, or you feel happier, or you feel safe. You know, sometimes when I'm sitting, I just feel like the world has its arms around me. I feel so safe, you know? And I think this is the deep sense of oneness, you know, deep sense of connection. Somebody wrote me an email the other day, and he said, I had a really deep sit of, in Mu, really deep experience of Mu. He said, for like a half an hour, I was in absolute emptiness. Now, as I said, I don't think absolute emptiness is just a state of mind. I actually think it's a dimension of reality. And this person was in an extraordinarily special state of oneness with that reality, with that absolute emptiness. And for half an hour. And just, it wasn't a thought in sight, just pure absorption. And that's quite rare. And the person said, why can't this happen all the time? Why is it so rare? And I said, you know, actually, that question is not quite, this is sort of like a small mind perception of the situation. You know, we make a distinction between that absolute emptiness and maybe like the world around us at a certain stage in our training. Those two things seem very separate. You know. But eventually, you know, eventually you realize, you know, if you stay in that emptiness long enough, you go there enough, you know, you begin to have this very powerful sense of connection to everything. And you realize that everything is, we say in Zen, we say everything is Buddha. Everything is my true self. And so the absolute emptiness is my true self. You know, the sound of the water fountain in the hallway is my true self. You know, and my true self takes many different forms. This might not make any sense, but it's all my true self. It's all one life. You know, and sometimes it takes a form of absolute emptiness, and sometimes it takes the form of the water fountain engine in the hallway. And sometimes it takes the form of pain in my leg, and sometimes it takes the form of delicious tea. But it all has one taste. You know, it all has one taste. Eventually. I promise you that'll be the case. So little by little, you know, if we keep practicing, we begin to experience more and more of the world as like part of ourselves, you know, part of our own life. And it's like participating in a bigger life. And when we walk down the hall after purifying body, mind, and heart, it's like the experience of walking is such an amazing adventure, right? It's so beautiful, and it's so connecting. You know, when we're walking normally, we're not even in the moment, right? We're sort of in a nowhere world. It's not mu, not emptiness. It's not in the moment. It's sort of like in this fantasy in our head. When we begin to slow down and we feel the pressure of the ground on our foot, you know, it's like a welcome home. You know, the world suddenly becomes so alive, so beautiful. And when it becomes alive in this way, we feel like we're home, you know, sometimes. If you're really there. You know. But even when you're not really there, you're home. You know, and a part of Zen practice is learning not to worry about it. You're home when you're on, and you're home when you're off. You know, sometimes you sit down on the cushion, and it's not a very good sit. You know, you can't get into the groove, or you have a lot of pain, or you're tired. That's also Buddha. And if you practice long enough, and it takes a lot of sitting, but if you practice long enough, everything becomes this beautiful experience, even the pain in your legs. And now to the koan. main subject. Ryu Tetsuma was a great woman Zen master in the Tang Dynasty. Came to Isan. Isan said, "Old female buffalo, so you have come." See? So these are like two deeply enlightened people who are friends. So Ryu Tetsuma goes to see Isan, and he says, "Oh, female buffalo, so you have come." And Tetsuma said, "Tomorrow there's a great festival at Taishan. Will you be going?" Isan lay down and stretched himself out. Ted Simmel went away. Well, I hope we have a chance to do this beautiful koan. But these are two people who are deeply, who feel very profoundly, very deeply, the oneness of everything around them. You know, Tetsuma, Ryu Tetsuma is Isan, and Isan is Ryu Tetsuma. It's a big mistake to think that people have enlightenment experience through their own efforts, actually. Please don't ever think that's true. If you don't practice a lot, if you don't sit a lot, nothing is going to happen. But actually, everything is happening together. You know, in Buddhist philosophy, there's this concept of, it's called cooperating causes, or it's called interdependent origination. It's very philosophical. But everything is happening, everything is one life, everything is happening together. You know, so, if you, it sounds crazy, but you know, sometimes I will read a book, and I didn't write the book, but you know, I'm so happy the book was written, you know, because it's one life. And I've read about great master Xu Yun and how he could sit without moving for 7 days, and I have to tell you, I can't do that, you know, not even close. But I'm so happy he's done it, because you know what, in a certain sense, it's also my accomplishment. See, it would be crazy to say you had a good sit. It would be crazy to say Joe had a good sit because Brian had some breakfast this morning, right? Say, Brian ate a little breakfast this morning, and Joe had a good sit. And you'd think, well, there's no connection there. But there is a connection there. I mean, you know, when we sit together in the morning, everybody's sitting so still. Everybody's working so hard, right? And if one person has a good sit, you know, it's everybody's good sit. This is really true, you know? I mean, seeing how this is so is quite important. You know, American people are so, we're all raised to be competitors, right? We're raised to be competitors. When I first started doing Zen practice, you know, people would answer their koan, and I wasn't jealous of them personally, but I felt so left out, you know, because I wasn't answering my koans. And if I had practiced a little more, maybe I would have noticed that, you know, it's all one life. You know, everything has one taste. And it's like, if you practice long enough, you're so happy for other people's happiness. You know, you're really, in a way, it's like you're more happy for other people's happiness than you are for your own. Of course, you're happy about your own happiness, too. But you know, your happiness is my happiness. Your stillness is my stillness. You know, if we all move around on the cushion, it's harder for all of us to sit. And if we're all still, it's easier. We're all helping each other, right? And if anybody had a good sit today, I'd like to take credit for it, you know? And I'd like to enjoy it, you know? And I will if you tell me about it, you know? It's like that. It doesn't make, you know, in a small mind way, it doesn't make any sense. You know, Brian's breakfast helped Joe have a better sit. And we said, that's impossible. But it's not so. Everything is you know, one day I saw an advertisement in a newspaper for a Tibetan meditation center in Seattle. And I went and I ran into a person who just happened to be, have met somebody who knew about Genki Roshi. And so everything, all this happened by accident. I didn't make any of it happen, right? And you know, I've had some wonderful sits, and I didn't do it. I didn't do it. They just happened. They just popped into existence, you know. But when I think about, everybody has helped me so much in my life. Genki Roshi, Webb, my parents, for all of my father's insanity, you know, helped me enormously to be here now. It's like this, it's all like this web. It's all like this beautiful interconnected system. And it takes a whole planet to make it possible for you to have a good sit. Really, it takes a whole universe. And we might think, well, this is just a human concern, but it's really not so, you know. It's like the whole universe is helping us sit. And that sounds crazy, but if you keep sitting, you'll really feel it in your bones, you know. And we should be so grateful to this beautiful world for allowing us to live in this way. So I'm so grateful to, when I say, I am so grateful to you for coming here, I really mean it, because your presence here made my sit so beautiful today. And it makes my life so wonderful. And I hope I am helping you to live your life. And I'm really quite grateful for your help. And I'm grateful to Genki Roshi, and I'm grateful to Webb. And I'm also grateful to people I haven't met. One of the people, this last week, you know, we about 3 weeks ago, I think, maybe it was a little bit more than that, Master Sheng Yan died, great Chinese Chan master. Sheng Yan died. Now, I've met Sheng Yan, but I didn't train with him. But nevertheless, Sheng Yan helped me to have a good sit this morning, really and truly. And somebody else who helped me to have a good sit was this woman whose picture is on the altar, and her name was Vimala Thakkar. She was a deeply awakened Indian practitioner. So I don't know her personally, but I'm very grateful to her, because it's all one life. See, this is like what I think Buddhism is all about. It's like one life. It's all one life. So.